Welcome back to another episode of the Becoming Conscious podcast. Today I speak with Daniel Goertz. Daniel is someone that I deeply respect. His work and his writing have been deeply influential in my life in many, many ways. So essentially how I found Daniel was through studying integral theory, led me to his work. He has worked on fleshing out this theory called metamodernism. And metamodernism is really interesting in that it essentially, his work takes the theories of developmental theories, integral theory being one of them. Also, I've interviewed on this podcast Suzanne Cook-Greuter, who has another developmental model. And what Daniel Goertz and his co-writer essentially do is they flesh out metamodernism as that which is beyond postmodernism, or it's post-postmodernism, and essentially flesh out what that means. And so you have pre-modernism, modernism, postmodernism. We get into this in the podcast a bit, but metamodernism is that with both transcends and includes postmodernism. And essentially how I see the core components of it is that it sees that not all hierarchies are bad, and it's able to resonate and relate with each of these different stages of development, pre-modern, modern, and postmodernism. It's able to see the value in each of these and relate to them and create solutions and ways of understanding what is happening in the world, and able to create solutions that honor each of these perspectives. And this to me feels like, deeply internalizing this perspective feels to me like the start of understanding why there's so much polarization in the world, and how to relate to what is happening in the world in a way that actually seeks to understand and not contribute to more polarization. And so we talk a lot about these ideas, as well as many more in this episode. I'm really excited for you to listen to it. So without further ado, Daniel Goertz. All right, welcome to the podcast, Daniel. I really appreciate you coming on the show today.
Thank you. So great to be here. And very good to get to know you a little bit when we talked right before we started recording.
Absolutely. Yeah, so as we talked about, there's a I'm a huge fan of your work, and there's a lot of different angles we can approach this. And so you talk a lot about metamodernism in your books, and we touched a little bit on how, you know, a lot of times, I learned this concept in the developmental model sphere, Ken Wilber, integral theory, stage theory. And one of the things that really attracted me to your work was the political philosophy angle to it. And like, how do we use these developmental model concepts in a way to look at culture, to look at society, and how society operates on a cultural level, but also like nations, global, et cetera. And so, yeah, really excited to speak with you about this today and to see what comes up for us in terms of like, how do we use these models to like help us inform how we're relating to culture, how we're existing in the fabric of culture and showing up, and et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, thank you, Ethan, for that invitation. Well, if we're dramatic about it, the issue is that modernity is flawed. And flawed in a fatal sense, flawed as in, well, we can't tell the future, but flawed as in doomed. And if you go through the base suppositions of upon which our societies are based, which do include growth upon growth, within the relationships, the material relationships of the economy of the people involved, and that is the legitimization of the government and the form of governance that we're part of. Then, well, infinite growth on an infinite planet doesn't work. It's also there's also a supposition of liberal values, but liberal values in a world of different civilizations with very, very different values will eat themselves up from the inside out. And there's also a supposition of human rationality and the freedom of the individual, but the freedom of the individual in a world where the individual gets more and more cybernetic and interconnected and prompted, and the science and artificial intelligence of manipulating our behaviors and even our desires and our personnel and the formation of our identities and personalities and ideologies and positions and values. Is also going to eat itself up. The rationality is going to be emptier and emptier and more irrational. The more we defend the presupposition of rationality, the worse off we're going to be in defending ourselves against the fruits of our technological and scientific endeavors, which are now undermining our very individuality and rationality in a sense, right? Of course, rationality, if once you look into the word, has many layers. So there's that problem too on a theoretical level. So we need to critique modernity and we need to reshape it. And usually that movement is called, or the impetus or structure of that critique has in so many ways, shapes, and forms been called postmodernism. I use the term postmodernism, as you're very well aware, but not all listeners might be. I use it in a very qualified way that is different from its overall discourse, its place in the overall discourse, where it's more or less equated with post-structuralist theory in academia and a few crazy forms of architecture and stuff like that and art. But postmodern is more this in the way I use the term is more of a stage of development that critiques and questions modernity and says that, okay, modernity, this doesn't hold up. You say this is a universal project that includes all of humanity, but there are so many blind spots, there are so many self-contradictions, it undermines itself, it's its own ecological base substrate, etc., etc., etc. You have feminism, ecologism, literary critique, discourse analysis, all of these things, right? Sensitivities to relationships of power, critical race theory, and so on and so forth, that are within the postmodern critique. Now, so the critique is gonna correct modernity, right? Wrong. The problem is that the critique is also flawed. And we now have two big camps. We have three big camps, actually. We have three big camps. We're saying, one part is saying modernity is awful and flawed, and this is what you'll learn if you do a liberal arts education anywhere in the world almost. And we need to critique it, and the better you are at critiquing those who critique it, the higher up you go in the pecking order of critiquers, and then you're going to be real good professors and activists and so forth, and you're going to somehow mitigate climate change and include the excluded or support the disempowered and so on. And you're going to break the chains of modernity, the invisible chains, and you're going to emancipate humanity and maybe a non-human life as well. That's one camp. The other camp is saying, well, wait a minute, there are so many problems with this whole postmodernism thing that people are confused, they're alienated, they feel values are shoved down their throats, they're shamed, people are silenced by all of these norms about being anti-aggressions. You're marking every word people say, you're doing things that are blatantly counterproductive. And this is, I mean, I just had a conversation with a person experienced in the climate change deliberations just before this call. And she gave very clear examples of this happening again and again, which is why she called a metamodernist, by the way, how postmodern values shoot themselves in the foot, alienating people, going down these discourse analyses or these discourse spirals where I critique you critique me, and at the end of the day, it's that eats up all agency, all positive thinking, right? And all positive thinking, not in the naive sense of thinking happy thoughts, in the sense of positing something, being for something, doing something, right? We're suggesting things, right? And there's a huge culture war. So that this other the critics of postmodernists, they say, no, don't go there. Close down the sociology departments, roll back this crazy relativization of everything, this take personal responsibility again, man and woman up. You apply common sense, they'll say, and go back from postmodernism, back to modernism, back to modernity, back to our roots, back to Western values, they'll say, or stuff like that. Well, then there's a third camp who says, well, modernity is rotten, but we should go back to something even further back, traditional societies. We should be more spiritual. We should be more evangelical, more Islamic, more Buddhist. There are many different versions of this, but they tend to correlate roughly with axial religions or with nationalist movements of different kinds. Well, and beyond that, you should go back to pagan values and like really, really nationalist movements and so forth, right? So nobody's saying, almost nobody's saying, how about you find a productive critique of the critique? What's the critique? What's a critique of a critique? What's a negation of a negation. So postmodernism is a negation of modernity. And if you think about it, you'll have to hate modernity even if you love it. And I sometimes use, I think you might have heard you mention another podcast that where you listened to me, and I think I said this in this same podcast, that if you transported you and me back to the Roman Empire, and you look at the world order during the Roman Empire, you say, wow, you're building aqueducts, you're doing this, you're doing that, you're interconnecting the whole Mediterranean, you're raising GDP all over the place, you're maintaining peace in places that have been warring for centuries. Well, you would still have to be against the Roman Empire. Why? Well, because they nail people to crosses and it's a slave economy. Right. And it's also highly aggressive, and only certain members of society are Roman citizens. It's a very imperfect democracy, and to the extent it was a democracy, could collapsed very quickly. So, or republic. So, if you look at all those things, you still have to be against the Roman Empire, and in the and the whole world order of that time. And in that sense, people, if we look soberly and conscientiously at our world order, we can easily enumerate all those fantastic things that would correspond to the fantastic things of the Roman Empire. but you still have to be against it fundamentally. You want to go back to a place where people are a lot more discriminated or against. You want to go back to a place where we're not more sensitive to the environment. You want to go back to a place where we're not taking in sociological sensitivity about the contexts of our social contexts and how those affect our decision making and so forth. You want to go back to John Stuart Mill, to mention like a standard classical liberal thinker, and just stick around there for the rest of humanity's future in a world that's evolved exponentially and very, very, very rapidly and just dramatically, really, like fundamentally since his time. You think they figured it out in the 19th century, the sort of base values we should live by and organize our societies by. You must be freaking crazy. That answer doesn't hold, right? So if you're saying no to postmodernism and to postmodern critique because you sense it's wrong, it's oppressive, it leads to these witch hunts, and all of those things, it remains in the critique and the no saying all the time. Naysaying, then, well, wouldn't it be more rational, or no, wouldn't it make more sense to critique the critique in a way that inverts it? So what's the critique of the critique, the negation of the negation? What's, if postmodernism is skepticism of the modern project, what's skepticism of the skepticism? And if you think about it, it's obvious that it's not just going back to modernism. The skepticism of the skepticism means skeptically applied skepticism, not naively applied skepticism. And here it gets a little complicated, but if you zoom back and you say, all right, it's not actually complicated, it's just a bit of a tongue wrenching thing. Like the skeptics, like the skepticism of the skepticism becomes a new naivety or a new sincerity, right? It's a post, or if you're ironic towards postmodern irony, if you're postmodern about your postmodernism, right? Then you the irony inverts and you end up with the quality or the stance or vibe or style even. Sensibility is the word I'm looking for. The sensibility of sincere irony or serious playfulness, right? Or because the issues are so serious and the stakes are so high, we need the best of what human creativity can muster, and the only space within which we can be that creative, that cooperative, that forward thinking, that long term in our perspectives, that inclusive of other perspectives, and that coordinating of many perspectives, and make those sorts of cognitive and emotional and social identity-based leaps, as we need to do, the only place is play, right? So we sort of have to go from the whole dead serious, so from the whole dead serious critique in postmodernism, like, hey, you ravaged our planet, you destroyed our civilization, and so on, right? The only place you can go from there, forward and not backwards, is into a sort of playfulness reconstruction of modernity. So given and then looking at, well, all this critique, it doesn't lead to a clear alternative. What it's leading to rather is a fracture, but we need to be very sensitive towards the social realities of all of the groups that we just outlined. So from traditional, even national, like even, you know, pagan, like even the Proud Boys that ran into the Capitol and all that, even those we have to try to understand. It's a little less central, but But the three big ones here, understand traditionalists, respect them, that they're coming from somewhere, understand mainstream modernity, respect it, right? And understand the postmodern critique, then find the coordinate, like, and here's where the word meta comes in, right? In a sense, the word meta is dumb, because meta in Greek means the same as post in Latin, but yeah. But the two have different connotations. They mean, both mean after, right? But meta also has the connotation of beyond or trend or going through. So the meta perspective is sort of, if you look at all these three that we mentioned from the side and you try to figure out the best function for switching between them and when, and it's case sensitive, right? The metamodern society that we try to envision in the books, The Listening Society and Nordic Ideology, is a society informed by that need, right? By the need to mediate and non-arbitrarily coordinate and case-sensitively coordinate in a non-arbitrary manner, traditionalist impulses, modernist impulse, postmodernist critiques, in a way that is nevertheless uncompromising. No traditionalists, you're not gonna make the world about Jesus Christ all over again and then oppress everybody who disagrees and go after gay people. We're not gonna let that happen. We're hearing you though on your sense of lack of existential depth in current society and your longing for community and your sense of loss and betrayal that these things have been smashed to bits by freaking McDonald's. And we're hearing you, modernity, that people are putting straitjackets on you, shaming you, forcing you into boring and denigrating DEI conferences, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And you're not getting it, but you have to follow along because the postmodernists have an upper hand in the culture wars, as we might get to, or they have higher cultural capital, so they can get you in the media and so forth, right? And destroy your career if you don't comply, right? We hear you, and we see that that's not fair, and we're going to try and help you. Postmodernists, we hear you. Western modernity colonized the shit out of the world. It's like if India is nationalist today and China is nationalist today, it's because, well, somebody woke those ghosts of Christmas past. And it wasn't that, actually, it was the West who woke those. The West then consumed throughout the 20th century, letting out all the CO2 gas emissions, and now they want to regulate everybody else who's an emerging economy, and so on and so forth. And patriarchy is a thing, and this whole thing is going to crash within a matter of generations if we don't radically reevaluate and change our positions. You need to take this freaking seriously. We hear you. And you're going to fail on all accounts on all of your main values other than marginal victories if you do not include and coordinate with the perspectives of the other two groups, which are going to outnumber you for all foreseeable future. And that's why the world needs metamodernists, who will then start to think about this whole and try to suggest institutional innovations. Not just that, but many things. There are many things that come out of this new sensibility, which is, you know, emerging in these last few decades only, I suppose. But But there's a bridge there. If people are familiar with integral theory, they would have noticed that what I'm saying is roughly the same thing. The framing is different, though. Integral theory says, well, the people who can hold these many perspectives are the people who are spiritually mature enough to do so, and thus there's a huge focus on spiritual awakening, as you pointed out in our pre-recording conversation. Metamodernists say, yeah, that's one aspect of it, but the larger emerging pattern of values is not necessarily based on spiritual awakening, or have it, or may not even have it as its central piece. It can come from so many different angles and directions. It can be through an intellectual journey. It can be through a journey of life experiences. It can be through an emotional journey of family trauma and healing. It can be through interacting with and resonating with certain cultural artifacts that put you in this both-and space of enlightened madness, if you like, right? When you know it's a joke, but you're still believing it, sort of, yeah, self-hypnosis, chaos magic, stuff like that, come close, are close to hope. Close to home to this attractor point we're talking about. So there's this space of sincere irony, and that's a sort of sensibility shift from integralism. This is my version, by the way, or the version that I develop and represent, and not just mine, of metamodernism. Other metamodernist scholars would disagree with any of these connections to integral theory, but would agree on the upon the what we all agree upon is some sort of sensibility of sincere irony, etc. But there, that should be mentioned and honored in, so people understand that it's a broad term and a contested term.
Absolutely. Yeah, thank you for laying out the ground of.
Well, so we will have to take a little break. Are you okay with the
So yeah, thank you for laying the foundation of metamodernism. I feel so much clarity around it. Feels like you just summarize like the essence of it, or what it's attempting to do. And so now I would love to take like this essence that we set for that we you just laid the groundwork for, and start talking about some of how this could play out in society, culture, in the political arena. And yeah, I'm going to tee you up a couple different ideas that you've talked about in your books, and I'm curious if you can see one of them that feels most applicable to yeah, like how do we actually enact metamodernism, or like how can I personally, individually, and also on a collective level show up for this? And you know what I was hearing you say with like being sensitive to each of the I started making connections between sensitivity to each of pre-modernism, modernism, postmodernism, and like really being like, I hear you. This is a pro like we get the frustration here, we get the frustration here, we understand, I understand. And a lot of what I was reading in Nordic ideology was like a sensitivity to the inner domain of the individual in all that that entails, not just the spiritual meaning domain, but the you talk about in Nordic ideology, Gemeinschaftspolitik, if I'm saying that right, which is like the shame and the guilt and the in these different like in one there's guilt is the one that's running the show, and one there's shame running the show, and like how do we get to a place where how we're relating to each other doesn't like trigger that or create the conditions that guilt and shame fester, but actually like so that collectives can support each other in ways that, you know, value each other's self-esteem and don't tear each other down in order to make me feel better or something like that. And yeah, I guess what I sit with is like if I'm becoming sensitive to that, I'm very, very intrigued by this idea of game denial, acceptance, and change. And how do I bring this idea of like we're playing these games, we're in these arenas, and it feels like a lot of the curious your thoughts on this. A lot of like pre-modern or modernism is like the game is like game acceptance and the game is great and let's play the game, and postmodernism seems to be like almost game denial, like the game is bad, let's deny the game. So how do we take this meta-modern like game change, like let me play the game but change it so that it's more ethical, more inclusive, and supports the inner well-being of the individual, and
Well,
yeah.
actually, if it's okay, then that I think we should break there because you already threw a bunch of bolts. So I'll already have to pick and choose a little bit in
Perfect.
order to respond. And if I
That
try
was
to
the
be fairly brief about it, then you can bring up the next point maybe, or else we might well miss key topics or other things. So I want to say about Gemeinschaft politics. So okay, in the book Nordic Ideology, we suggest a bunch of and this is, I mean it's in a sense very theoretical. So in a sense very theoretical because we're on the one hand we're seeing all of these projects out there in the world, and they do fall into these six baskets. That they're either about humanities or society's way of dealing with existential health, and mental health, and so on, which we term existential politics, or it's they're about our relationships, like ethnic relationships or loneliness epidemics and whatnot, right? And those things fall into the basket of Gemeinschaft. So Gemeinschaft is a German word. It means something like something somewhere in between fellowship, as in the experience of being in social rapport with one another, and community, right? So it doesn't mean exactly any of those things, but it means both and. Both of those things, sort of, or it can mean either or. And then you have democratization politics of trying to complexify the tools with which we can govern ourselves. And then there are three more I'm not going to go into. But if you look at those things, they're out there as little sparks, little bubbles of potential, but there's no like they haven't yet reached a place where they interconnect. And what the argument we make in the book is that these things have not, they can't live or survive for long in a modern society because like the environment is not fertile soil. You need all the six together. Things are sequential even here, so democratization politics comes first. Why? Because if you politicize the discussion about something like community, and it's not, then you have to be very, very, very democratically sensitive, or else it becomes somebody else telling you how to be friends. Across ethnic groups or whatever. So that's paternalism, and it's going to not actually create genuine, it's not going to be genuinely sensitive to the social relationships, right, at hand. So if you look at that, you see there's this position of all or nothing. And you have a corresponding, because all of the six dimensions of what we envision as postmodern, as metamodern politics, sort of co-depend or co-arise in a way similar to the institutions of modernity. So you have a bunch of liberal democracies in the world, and what are you going to see there? You're going to see that you have fairly low levels of corruption. I mean, it's all relative, but globally speaking. And you're going to see that you have freedom of speech, and at the same time, you have independence of courts, and you're going to see a bunch of things like that. Well, the tripartite division of powers, for instance, and that the government can't also be the parliament, can't also be the courts, for instance. And rule of law. And if you remove one of these, all of the others fall. And they're just not possible. And if you want to go deeper than liberal democracy does, right? We're going to go deeper into the human soul, or like, which we, the event, current events lead us there. You have what? Loneliness epidemics, nihilism in the youth and apathy. You have online addictions and declining mental health. You have disconnection from the environment. You have the decline of family relationships. Like, of course, if you want to improve society, just pouring more growth on that, improving on the apps and the gadgets and so forth, is unlikely to go deep enough on in fixing that issue, or fixing addressing those issues. But on the other hand, in our current debate or form of governance, and just, well, just I should say form of government, and our constitutional forms of just the basic principles on which our constitutions are based, and the democratic cultures around them, and so forth. All of those issues are sort of off the map. They're off the menu, I should say. But if you want to go deeper into those issues, you first have to evolve the institutions so that the institutions can do so more sensitively, but also with maintained legitimacy. And at this point, then, we're likely to be seeing a sort of pressure that goes either into authoritarianism or into, because the authoritarian will be able to do these things and pressure people into them, address these more subtle issues without democratic legitimacy or pretended democratic legitimacy, and then undergird that by, shutting people up with the sanctions of different sorts. Or you'll go in the direction of decaying institutions, because the institutions will be weaker and weaker in addressing these subtler issues that are more and more paramount to actually to the actual causal processes of the reproduction and development and evolution of society. So again, there's a sort of both and that is also a neither nor. The both and is developing enough democratic legitimacy and sensitivity for us to be able to delve into these deeper issues. That's the core. So issues of existential health, existence of spiritual connection and purpose in our lives, issues of socialization through the social settings we're part of, issues of alienation between the genders, and formation of families and so forth, and the whole dating dynamics in society. And when dating, I mean, if you were a conventional economist, sounds like trivia. Like, we're talking the rise and falls of nations over here, and growth that can in a generation transform poverty-stricken nation to world leaders in this side of tech. And you want to talk about dating? But on the other hand, look at societies where the dating scene has broken down. South Korea, do they have big problems with this? The amount of problems and the amount of human misery that comes out of it is humongous. And not only that, it's the very wealth that has been managed to be, that has been acquired is, well, it's been very, very pricey, and it becomes pretty bittersweet at the end. You lost sense of community and so forth, right? And sacrificed your existential health and so on in this pursuit. So, and is that a threat to the society? Well, yeah, look at the demographics. So this society will come tumbling down. Why? Because you cannot maintain rags to riches stories when every adult maintains one child and two aging adults that are off the labor market. That's what happens in places like that. Plus the personal development of the population and thus their innovation capacity compared to others stalls in situations where people cannot express and explore the erotic and romantic sides of life, because the dating market is entirely broken, because traditional society was not integrated with modern society, was not integrated with postmodern critique of it. The whole thing was squished in a too short demographic span and a too rapid development. According to modernity, progress, modernity's mainstream discourse, progress is a good thing, but just common sense, really, everything is good and bad, and everything that goes up comes down one way or another. And modernity is coming back down on, unfortunately, on a lot of measures. And we are starting to notice this since 15 years back or so that, wait a minute, at the very peak of the victory of the liberal blah, 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 and things start growing and fantastic things happen, and then democracy starts subsequently declining in the world. That's where we're going for 14 years in a row. We're so enlightened and so on. And at the same time, we're risking some sort of collective semi-suicide with both AI and climate change. Obviously, this is a rationality or modernity run amok, right? So we need a new form of politics. And what I want to say about the enactment of that is that it's complex. And what do I mean by that? Worst cop out ever, I know. But what I mean is, with complex means that, what is metamodernism? You really look at it. Well, so out there are things that are happening in the world, and then there are patterns to those things, so systems, and then there are institutions that coordinate all the systems, so systems of systems, and then there are principles or paradigms that coordinate the coordination of the coordination of things that happen in the world. So we're looking at patterns of patterns of patterns. So when we're talking about metamodernism, we're talking about the cube of a pattern, right? Pattern times pattern, pattern times pattern. So that means that you have several steps of translation down to each concrete application, which really does play out in the crowd where we're talking to about these things. So you are one of the readers who show up and and talk about these books and so forth, and you happen to have a tech and business background and a spiritual background and a holistic thinking background, and you happen to be from Boulder, Colorado, was it? Or somewhere else, Colorado? Yeah, Boulder, Colorado. So you happen to be from Mecca, basically, right? And and other people who show up are climate change activists, therapists and doctors, artists, designers, people work in the UN with organizational development or implication, et cetera, et cetera. And within each of these fields, people find metamodernism to be relevant, which is interesting. They're completely different fields. Why is that the case? And almost nobody actually calls us up to ask what you just asked. What about the politics? What you actually wrote about? And of course, it's because, well, it's complex. So it's a pattern of a pattern of a pattern. So the people who are already deep into their field and already critique the critique, they're the ones doing the translation and doing the things that eventually change things happening in the world. And the variability and just width of that, of those applications, it is just completely unpredictable to me, or it was beforehand. And each of the things where people start applying metamodern thinking, et cetera, is completely unpredictable. And what's more, it requires much more sensitivity to that particular context and topic. I'm sorry about the background noise here. So this is all just a huge qualifier. It's not actually, I'm not trying to get off the hook about the question of enactment, but the qualifier is that the enactment happens when perspective changes have occurred in key people at key moments, right? And then they sort of know through their context, through their expertise, through their embodied experience and their own engagements, what the enactment can be. And the enactment then becomes a sort of new field, because on average and over time, these people will increase the likelihood of one another's success. Or this is what we're noticing. We're seeing, for instance, people showing up for our courses. So there will be an artist who is a metamodernist speaking to a scriptwriter who is metamodernist, and or an animator in the movie industries. And they will find ways to work together where they unlock each other's thing, right? Yeah. On average, right? So maintaining a fairly wide network is a big thing of how this works. With that in mind, this dynamic in mind, it's very, the enactment is very, very indirect. And we should be very wary of a Lenin version of this, like this pamphlet, do this, kill those people, we're fine. No, it's so non-linear that you sort of feed a field, but you don't use that as a cop-out for actually not doing anything and like, I'm just being a metamodernist, right? People have all these things, excuses and so on. You're actually very, very stringently applying a sort of action logic to your field, to this whole field of metamodernism, and to the application and translation of metamodernism into your reality or your field of expertise or agency. And there's a likelihood that over time surprising insights can come and you can redefine how you do things in your field, but it takes many years usually to hit the gold strain. And it doesn't happen to everybody, of course. It's you also have to get lucky to just find the right angle and so forth. Now, but taking your question a little bit more at face value and just naively answering it, what about like, how do you enact? How do you get metamodern institutions in the USA? And how do you get metamodern institutions in Sweden? And the simple answer is that Sweden, where we were as a country in 2015, was approaching this sort of attractor point. But it sort of missed it and started going in the other direction and had to do so. I am sorry, I have to break for a moment and let my wife in and a kid. Hey.
Awesome, yeah. So we were talking about Gemeinschaft, politics, community.
Well, yes.
Shaping culture. Yeah, I guess what I was really hearing you say in all of that was that, like, we can't talk about specific enactments of metamodernism because it's like this pattern of patterns, and that when by talking about the pattern in an individual, when they learn that pattern or start seeing the world through that pattern, then in their individual context, they will find a way to enact that, but in a way that is inaccessible to us now because we're at the pattern level. And if we wanted to talk about specifics, we could go down any which way.
Yes, but there's a yes and, right? So that was the qualifier. That was the qualifier before we go into the question of what can you do for in terms of creating metamodernist institutions. And Sweden was sort of going that direction as a sort of forerunner. And then, well, if there's a metamodernist sort of attractor point over here where things start going in a metamodern direction and you go through modernity and postmodernity, like sort of came close. Well, you could see more and more metamodern-ish dynamics in Sweden, not just Sweden, Denmark too. And Finland's doing a little better now, but then they sort of missed the opportunity and going in sort of the opposite direction in many, many ways. So, which might be necessary in the larger scheme of things, right? Because, well, if they couldn't hit that spot, was because there were some backlog of stuff that needed to be integrated and talked about again, and, well, ghosts and all that stuff that you needed to deal with. But overall, you could say that in countries like over here, you have a multi-party system. Proportional elections, which allows for, at least theoretically, the introduction of a new party that is transpartisan and metamodern driven, and that has and that starts to strategically apply this, okay, we're going to optimize the actual interactions between the different parties, and in that trying to nevertheless not just optimize it non-directionally, but optimize it with a view of the developmental pathway towards deeper integration of personhood and society, right? Self and society, to speak the sociological language. Now, that could happen in countries like over here, given enough good circumstances. Finland is not a more conservative country than Sweden, but it's much closer to that attractor point, given its much higher stability in terms of institutional realities. Part of that might actually have to do with the less immigration in the country, because, well, we're at a bit of a roadblock over here because many issues were hijacked by the whole integration immigration problem and so forth. And on the other end of that, though, if Sweden is successful in integrating those issues and turning around violent spirals and being a successful multi-ethnic story that is very cosmopolitan in its outlook, if it can successfully go through these painful phases and land at on the other side, that would be a side that's even closer to metamodernism, even more ready for it, and could play a very interconnected role in the world given its multi-ethnic composition. So I mean, it's a high-risk situation right now, but the stakes and potentials are high for a country like Sweden. For a country like the United States, politics or in the constitutional forms are older even, and the rules of the game are a little more constrained in that sense. So metamodernists in the United States may need to think along other axes than the political or state bureaucratic pathways, and that might mean market solutions and civil society solutions. Now, if you look at what my friend Nick Pinkston is doing over in California, he's looking at a model that is entirely market-based, where he takes investor money, venture capital, but the venture capital is not invested in a product, but a promising person from a disprivileged background. And then there's a holistic view of that person and helping them with anything really, but trying to get them a high-end tech job at the end where they will pay back a part of their salary. And the actual payback tends to be higher than a company, interestingly enough, because, well, getting a whole company to work is a pretty complex endeavor. If you just take a high potential individual who just didn't have the right background, and it's fairly straightforward. Well, remove their obstacles, and they will be able to support them, and they will be able to perform, and they'll pay you back. They'll pay you back at a good interest, right? And if it fails, they won't be. If they fail themselves, which is not in their interest to do, that's sort of already included in the risk calculation. Poor people won't owe rich people money as a result, right? And that can increase social mobility in the United States, and it can interconnect them, and they can share resources because those people from less privileged backgrounds but with good potential will still know other people from less privileged backgrounds, and then they can be expected to give a little bit back to their community and so on and so forth, right? So that would be a way of applying the listening society principle. Society, in this case, market agents, listening, really listening to the needs of an individual. Of course, it's a little less wide scale. It's a little more individualist, and it's a lot more American. But this could actually work market style as well in some ways. And if there's one such solution, and so that's not exactly the Nordic ideology ideas, but the more baseline listening society ideals. But there's if one such innovation came out of one entrepreneur's mind, who is a metamodernist, I'm sure if you think, let's say we think up 100 such innovations, which that work. And reproduce themselves and grow and actually turn a comparable or higher profit to other market allocation mechanisms, then you might be seeing the movement towards a more highly developed, diverse, and inclusive and listening society in the United States. And another friend, also American, also in California, Brandon Orgard, he takes the whole six dimensions of the Nordic ideology, which we have only mentioned, of which we have only mentioned three in this podcast, and applies them to a civil society, to a civil society project in California. I don't think this thing loads yet, but there's this ambition and people are trying things out, right? So working and civil society project like these might, for instance, ally with market agents like the one we just mentioned. And that whole way of working is different than postmodernism. So why? Well, here we get into the game change rather than the game denial thing, right? So if we'll simplify at an extreme here, but if modernity says, well, capitalism is good, so pull yourself up by the bootstraps and whatnot, you eventually play the game, and through our interactions of partly competing, partly trading, we end up inadvertently having cooperated and so on. And yeah, postmodernists say, well, nah, what about the animals who are eating? What about et cetera, et cetera? What about the environment? There's a third party who never got paid and blah, 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 right? What about norms that skew the allocation of venture capital to, I think it's in my country, it's actually 99, 98% to men and 2% to women. And in your country, I think it's 96%, but it's patriarchal. So, oh, it's free will. Like, is it? And then I get that guys are a little more high risk entrepreneur types than girls on average, but 98, no, it's crazy. And it's obviously not free will. There's obviously structures involved of the social structures and norms and presuppositions and blind spots and whatnot, right? And beyond that, beyond that, or that would be a sort of denying the game, right? The first would be accepting the game. The second would be denying the game. I say, like, no, stop, stop capitalism, stop doing this. Fight for indigenous people and so on, right? But well, if you look at the whole thing, colonialism, for instance, or well, let's be anti-colonial, post-colonial, etc. Or let's critique post-colonialism. Fair. Like if wrongs were wrongs, then by all means, let's address them. Let's make wrongs right. Let's straighten thing out what was crooked. But the game denial aspect is, but wait a minute, if we look at all the other civilizations, compare, not all, but most other civilizations, comparable things were happening all the time, just on maybe a little lesser scale. But if they would have spread and dominated and been hegemonic, the same thing would have happened. So how can the solution to domination be to end the domination of just one group? Well, you have to think a little farther. What's the underlying? How about the Arabs as slavers in East Africa and so on and so forth, right? How about Aztecs? Literally a war economy, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then this gets you into a game change position, which like the postmodernists would find it distasteful to try to change America with the help of only market and civil, well, civil society mechanisms would be fine, but there can't be too strategic and too planned out and too theoretically underpinned, right? Because you have to be grassroots, blah, blah, blah. But meta-modernists don't have those qualms. We buy the postmodern critiques, we buy the postmodern values, we buy the postmodern hurts and worries and concerns, but we want to propose things, we want to do things, we want to try things out, and we don't think modernity and its all of its inventions and institutions are inherently evil. We just think it's an aging system and it's killing itself, just like anything else. And we think it has its ups and downs, and we think it's a form of ethics, or it has a form of ethics, which is higher than the prior form of ethics, but lower than the later stages of ethics. So we want to evolve those ethics, and we think it's vital to do so, but we're happy to play and win according to those mechanisms, according to those very same mechanisms, by understanding them better, and working with them, like really seeing through their core principles, right? Seeing through the game that makes you win in capitalism, for instance. And to a postmodernist, that's usually viewed as impure. And what's worse is to the postcapitalist, to the postmodernist, that's viewed as impure. And the postmodernist mind will not be able to achieve its goals. Why? Because the critique still needs to be paid for. You still need to eat when you critique. And not only do you need to eat, you need to be comfortable, because critique comes from a place of abundance, actually, right? Revolution can come from a place of desperation, but critique in the sense of elaborate, multi-perspectival, intellectually salient, or intellectually sharp, and building on a wealth of knowledge and so on. All of this is a very refined form of educational personal growth that comes from abundance. Where is that abundance coming from? Well, usually it's tax money or borrowed money on the capitalist market. So, I mean, in a sense, postmodernism and modernism together are chasing a dog chasing its own tail. Right? Whereas metamodern solutions will look for, if it can't pay for itself, if it can't outcompete capitalism, I know you brought that up. If it can't compete capitalism on its own terms, capitalism has not been transcended and included. And this transcend and include theme you recognize, of course, from Ken Wilber and so forth, from integral theory, but integral theory never formulated a clear, because it didn't come from social theory, or because it didn't come from economics to begin with, it never formulated a clearly post-capitalist sentiment, which, by the way, it also crippled it as a movement, because it's inability to formulate a pure post-capitalism, which has the both andness or the sincerely ironically held superposition of not just capitalism but hyper-capitalism, and not just critique of capitalism but unapologetic anti-capitalism. That's the metamodern post-capitalist position, and that position which sees capitalist system for what it is, and its institutions for what they are, and its social logics and limitations for what they are, but plays it to transcend it, but has safeguards in order not to get eaten or corrupted by it. So what ended up happening is in integral was actually the very thing that that postmodernists would have warned about, namely that spirituality became a commodity and started being sold. And there is no recovery from once that's happened, right? So you need You need a growth mechanism, for instance, by investing in a person that, you know, gets a Google job or whatever, right, where a certain percentage of them do, and they're happy to pay back 20% because they would never have gotten in the ballpark of the ballpark of the ballpark of a damn Google job, right, or you know, high tech job, if you didn't have the support program, right. But the payback is huge in terms of, like, compared to you know, leaving your money with a random hedge fund manager or something. So you're out competing capitalism. You're running faster and you're reinvesting it in social capital, right? And where does this sort of thinking come from? Well, if you didn't have a sociological thinking, if you didn't have a non-capitalist thinking, you wouldn't have come up with this even more capitalist plan, right? Or, yeah, I'm mm-hmm. idealizing this particular project. I'm sure there are loopholes in it. So let's just use that as an example. I'm not saying this is going to be, I'm not saying Nick Pinkston's project particularly is going to save the whole United States. I'm just saying that's an example of this thinking, very applied, right? Mm-hmm. In an American context, right? So it isn't impossible, even though America has its developmental demographics, with which are farther from metamodernism, they also have the highest wealth of, I mean, just innumerable, just in absolute numbers, and they have the highest number of metamodernish people in the world. And if those collaborate, and not only that, Americans who do well tend to be they tend to be more higher achievers than Europeans that do well, because you have individual societies. So your society pushes people really far down, or it spurs growth really high up. And among those people in the growth really high up, the vast majority just end up on golf courses. But a minority of them instead go invest this into personal development or go in that sort of journey. And those all speak the same language, all know about the same country. It's the most central country in the world, culturally and economically still. So the potential actually for metamodernism in America is the highest. And if you then connect it to the geopolitics or of our time, where if you listen to analysts like this guy, Peter Zeihan, who analyzes demographics and countries and so forth and economies, he says that America, given its fairly secure grasp of resources that it can rely upon itself, and its fairly low reliance on import, and its large internal consumer market, has better chances to last during the deglobalization shaky times that are coming up. He doesn't talk about modernity and postmodernity and metamodernism or anything like that, but he analyzes those issues. And so if United States has good chances of weathering the winter, as it were, and it has high populations of metamodernism over a threshold, not like high proportionally, but high in absolute numbers, and you have very high competent and very moneyed, comparatively speaking, metamodernists that might speak the same language, even though your politics might not be anywhere close to metamodernism, because of many things, it's actually very indirectly the place that has the one of the highest potentials for enactment of metamodern politics, just through other means than the political arena, or only indirectly through the political arena. That was my point.
Awesome. Yeah, that was really fascinating. I'm tracking time here.
Yep.
I just feel really lit up, and my mind is going so many different places with all of this, and where to take it. And I really appreciate you coming on the show today and talking about metamodernism, combined shock politics, Nordic ideology, all of these amazing topics. And yeah, just thank you. And is there any last remaining things you would like to say?
Well, from my part to you, Ethan, and to listeners, I want to say that, well, today I had to have a little background noise. I'm sorry about that. I hope this is an okay quality listen either way. And I want to say just thank you for well, you showing up and being supportive and inviting me to this, Ethan. It's yeah, been a pleasure.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Becoming Conscious podcast. Given that you've made it this far, I deeply appreciate you listening to the entirety of this episode. It means a lot to me. I just do this out of pure joy. Being able to talk with people like Daniel, explore perspectives like this is just one of the most deeply fulfilling things that I do in my free time. And if you like the episode, hit the subscribe button or the follow button on Spotify, iTunes, wherever you're listening to this podcast, and reach out to me. I would love to start a conversation, would love to get in touch. Curious to hear what you thought about this episode. You can reach me at ethanwnel@gmail.com. And yeah, let me know what you think. So, thank you so much for listening to this episode. You can find the writing that I do on becomeconscious.substack.com. That is where you will find what I'm currently thinking about. And you can subscribe to my newsletter for free there. Also, you can find Daniel's work by either looking up metamoderna.com. I'm pretty sure that's what it is. Metamoderna.org, my bad. And you can also find his books. I'm currently reading his book called 12. It's called 12 Commandments. You can find that on Amazon. You can also find his core two-part series of books. One is called Nordic Ideology, and the other is called The Listening Society. These are the two books that first got me into Daniel's work under the pseudonym Hansi Freinacht. And yeah, definitely check them out. I would highly recommend them. Thank you for listening. I'll see you in the next episode.